Thank you very much. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the IRTP call today on the 19th of April. My name is Christina Nordström, and I will be filling in for Gisela for this and for a few IRTP calls ahead. And please feel free to correct me if I severely mispronounce any of your names. On the call we have Mike O'Connor, Kevin Erdman, James Bladel, Michele Nylon, Barbara Steele, Barry Cobb, Paul Diaz, Bob Mountain, and from staff, Marika Koenigs and Christina Nordström. And the apologies I have are from Anil George, Oliver Hope, Simonetta Batigir, and Badwin Chombe. And may I also remind you to please state your names before speaking for transcript purposes. Thank you very much, and over to the chair.
Thank you. As per usual, does anybody have any update to the statement of interest, conflicts of interest, or is it safe to assume you're all still as much capitalist or socialist as you were the last time we all spoke? Mikey, have you become a socialist?
Arr, I'm a pirate.
Okay, thank you. That's all I wanted to know. Okay, all the pirates are on the call. Perfect. Now, Mikey and James, you sent along an updated version of the Emergency Action Channel, which of course has become EAC, since this is ICANN and we can't possibly introduce something without making it into an acronym. Are there any, would you like to walk us through some of that, Mikey?
I'd be happy to. What I did is went through the transcript of the call and tried to capture all the conversations we had and sent a draft to James, and he caught a couple things that I goofed up. So James can chime in anywhere I go off the rails. One of the important structural changes is that this is really a change to two parts of the IRTP. The big long chunk is an insert into the Section 4 of the IRTP. And by the way, we might want to just renumber IRTP. The numbering in the policy as it stands right now is kind of erratic. But anyway, so the big chunk is in Section 4, but then there's one change to Section 6, which is where the undo language lives. And so I added that change at the bottom of this. So there's a structural connection between these two parts pointing back and forth to each other. The first thing that we did, we had a pretty long conversation about what is the goal of the EAC. And so that first paragraph got expanded to flesh that out a bit. There's a piece that I wrote that we finally decided to take out that we need to figure out what to do with, and that has to do with Simonetta's point about what are your other choices, go to court, et cetera, et cetera. And James and I decided that that probably didn't belong in policy, but probably involved some sort of educational material or website or something. So there's a piece that we haven't done yet, and we need to do something about. James, go ahead and just interrupt me when I go off the rails like that.
Oh, okay. Well, I just wanted to build on that, Mikey. There was a second paragraph there that listed the menu of options of ways that transfer issues could be resolved. And I think we were trying to achieve two things by removing it. One, we didn't want to be too prescriptive in policy that laid out a sequence or a recipe for what must be followed in a transfer dispute. And secondly, we wanted to emphasize that this is not a dispute resolution process or a guideline for a dispute resolution process, but this is simply a communication channel, an emergency communication channel. And so anything that subsequently came after that communication was established, we wanted to perhaps put somewhere out.
Yeah, like he said. I think I'll stop at this point and take questions on sort of the goal statement. I think that's the way to do this, just in case, because otherwise it'll get all collided at the end. But does this
Mikey, this is Haley.
Yeah, go ahead, Haley.
Just in the draft that's on screen there, it still refers to 24 hours, but I believe that both yourself and James had agreed in principle to changing that to 4 hours. Is that correct?
Yeah, I was going to get to that in a minute, but, you know,
okay.
Sorry.
I mean, I jumped the bows or jumped the something or other.
Jumped the gun, that's the term you want there.
So you have to remember, I come from a country where you can't get guns, so I don't
yeah,
ride very hard.
That's one of the beautiful things about living in the U.S., as along with being able to get dynamite. That's my favorite. Anything else about the goal statement? Okay, I don't see any hands, so we'll go on to the next. The next paragraph mostly was refining the point of contact. We
okay, Marika has her hand up.
To a telephone number or some other way that people can communicate in real time, and took out email. And then we also added in the radar reference. And a trivia question of the day is, what does radar stand for? James and I don't know, so I didn't expand that acronym. But
well, now, I didn't say I didn't know. I said I think it stands for nothing. So
that's true.
It's a nuance.
Yeah, that's
there.
True. I am assuming that it's got to stand for something. But that's true. It wasn't that we didn't know. But we had a lively debate about that. So anyway, the point of the changes in this paragraph, Marika's got her hand up. Maybe Marika knows. Marika?
This is Marika. I actually don't know what it stands for. I can imagine something like registrar, administrative, whatever. But I can find out what it means. I did have a comment on radar because I've been speaking to Tim Cole, whose team manages the radar system, and I think he just wanted to set the expectations straight on what radar currently does. And as I understand it, because we were talking about that radar might track who accesses what data, and that would be a way as well to control or have a view on who sees what. But I think what it currently does is that radar tracks who logs in and makes changes. It doesn't actually track who views what data. So, he did explain to me that if there would be the desire from this working group to have a system where, for example, radar would be used to actually log or start the EAC, you could envision creating a kind of email system or a form that a registrar would need to be fill in that would then as well have a timestamp and actual factual data of when an EAC would be initiated. I think at this stage it's not envisioned that the radar would also be used for a response, so you'd still need to track as well when another response is received. But so I just want to make clear what radar currently does, and I'm not an expert on all the technical details, and I think if the group wants to have a further discussion on that, we can get someone on the phone in one of the next calls to try to go through what is currently possible and if there are additional features the working group would recommend in the context of the EAC to get a kind of an idea of what that would entail and what kind of resources would be needed and time would be needed to implement that. I think we could discuss that.
Let me respond real quick, Marika, and then I'll jump over to James because his hand went up in the middle of that. But we're really just thinking at this stage of the game that radar would keep track of the contact information. It wouldn't do the logging. We had a pretty extensive discussion about that on the call last week that said that some of this stuff might be considered for a phase two implementation, but that for phase one, we wouldn't want to stress radar beyond what it can do today. James, go ahead.
Yeah. And I think more of what Mikey was saying, the two things we were looking for out of radar, Marika, would be, and I'd be happy to talk to Tim about this, would be, one, an area for registrars to publish the EAC contact information and have it labeled as their EAC contact, and then two, to restrict it so that it's only used by appropriate parties as defined later on in the term. And I think it will do those two things right out of the gate. Future things as far as, possibly tracking EAC messages and tracking response time, we understand that would be a huge feature build-out and would be something that we'd have to look at down the road as a refinement.
Okay, so, and I, I see in the chat that we're going to get to 24 hours in the next paragraph, but let's just wrap this one up and make sure that that we're on the same page about this one. If this is still confusing, it would be important to clarify this paragraph, but really what we're trying for here is the point of contact information only in radar. Okay, I think we're okay there. The next one.
Sorry,
sorry, Michele, go ahead.
I have a small problem with telephone number. Because we were talking about logging the fact that the contact was made.
Yeah, but we leave the logging duty in the hands of the respective registrars. That's down a...
Oh, I see. Okay.
So
okay.
It's the whole... So anyway, that logging stuff isn't addressed by this paragraph at all.
Okay, sorry. I'll shut up now.
No worries. Anything else on this paragraph, folks? Okay. Next one, and this is where we can pick up the 24-hour conversation again. Is pretty minor changes. Mostly just wording changes to clarify who's responding. But it is in this paragraph that we specify the length of time, and we did have a conversation that James started on the list about that time interval. And I think this is probably the right time to have that discussion. And James, maybe you want to kick that off.
Sure. This is James speaking. Thanks, Mikey. And the idea here being that while 24 hours is easy to measure and easy to remember, it is an incrementally small investment to go from a 24-hour response to a shorter response, which I suggested possibly is 4 hours. The reason being that when we talk about, especially in the area of hijacks, when we talk about harm, we're talking about something that's occurring that's measured in hours or minutes. So I think that responsiveness is key. I think most of the large registrars will probably assign this to existing support escalation processes. Smaller registrars may look to their own individual teams as well as possibly augmenting those with paid services. So I think that it's not outside the realm of reason to request that we have a faster reaction time and that this is truly for emergencies only. I think that we need to just keep in mind that there is a compounding harm element that goes on as the time goes on. So that was my reasoning behind requesting a shorter time window.
And this is Mikey. I agree wholeheartedly, and that's enough said, I think. Paul, go ahead.
Thanks, Mikey. Just wanted to say for the record, I agree with both what James said and what you've offered as well. It is very important to remember this is a very limited purpose, this channel, and the more time that goes by, 24 hours, I mean, think back to some of the cases that have been well-publicized, hijacking cases, how detrimental it would be if the gaining registrar, could drag it out as long as 24 hours. The other thing to note, and it's very clear in the text, is that this is the short time frame is for the initial response. Always, always, always. It's not resolution of the alleged hijacking. It's the response. It's there in the text, but we can't make that clear enough. It's to get the communication started within the short time frame, not to have the whole thing wrapped up to the complaining party's satisfaction.
Thanks, Paul. Marika first, and then Michele.
Yeah, this is Marika. I don't disagree or don't have a specific opinion on the time frame that should be given. One concern I do have, and then it's linked maybe as well to the second, the next paragraph, is that if a failure to respond results in the undo of a transfer, this actually doesn't prescribe what kind of information we need to be provided, or what time frame the the gaining registrar or the gaining registrar would have to respond and say, well, you know, I did respond, or, you know, here are the reasons why I didn't respond. You know, we had an earthquake, you know, whatever kind of situation there might have been, or valid excuse. So I'm wondering as well if anything more needs to be prescribed in this, or if it's the expectation that would be part of the implementation, you know, that staff would prepare on how this would be implemented and how the compliance would be measured. So that's a question I have in relation to reducing the time frame and how that would be linked to any time frame given for actually, before you actually undo the transfer, to make sure that there's due process and an opportunity to, you know, respond or clarify why there wasn't a response.
This is Mikey. I think, again, the confusion comes in how limited this is. I mean, you're right, Marika, in that there are possible circumstances, I suppose, where there's an excuse, but I think that they are so limited that we run the risk of sort of over-engineering this. You know, it's kind of like Bill Cosby, a famous American comedian who used to work into his jokes, "An elephant stepped on my homework. That's why I didn't hand it in." I mean, this, the scenarios where there's a valid excuse for not responding are so narrow that I think we'd probably struggle to come up with good ones.
Well, Mikey, would there be a situation as well where the losing registrar would just tell the registry, well, we didn't get a response, can you please undo? But where the gaining registrar, well, we did respond, where there's, you know, bad intent on the part of the losing registrar to, you know, undo the transfer. Is that a you know, I don't know if it's a realistic scenario, but I could see that happening.
Yeah, I think that's called fraud. And,
right.
You know, that's handled by courts.
Right, but then you still have a situation where the transfer has been undone. So I'm just wondering if there should be something in there where there is a kind of time frame, or I don't know if it's then the registry that makes that assessment, or, you know, picks up the phone and says, well, hey, they told us that you didn't respond. You know, are you finding that? I don't know if that's the discretion that is built in here, that it's still the registry at the end of the day, you know, that will undo the transfer and has some discretion there to, you know, take someone's word for it or ask for additional information or evidence. I don't know if that's what is foreseen here.
I'm going to let Bladel take this one. His hand up went up there. You want to take that one, James? But you're muted, you rascal.
Can I jump in, Mikey?
Sure, go ahead, McKeon.
Related directly to what Marika is saying. Just first off, I wanted to echo what the others are saying, that I support the concept, because as far as I'm concerned, it's an SLA-type scenario. So even if you want, you know, you contact us and we have to respond. As long as you don't expect us to resolve it, that's fine. I mean, you know, not resolve it immediately, in other words. So it's a non-issue. I don't see... Most registrars are going to have 24/7 staff on call, if not actually sitting at a desk. With respect to Marika's comments, while I can understand her fears, you're moving into something which is out of scope of this. This is a very, very narrow, in my understanding, this is a very, very narrow mechanism to start communication going. If somebody abuses it, then the same kind of sanctions that would be available under normal circumstances through civil action or otherwise would be available. At least that's my understanding. But I'd let James speak to that if he can unmute himself.
I am unmuted. Thank you for your patience.
Hey, there he is. Go ahead.
I was getting the little hourglass sign on my phone trying to unmute, which is always fun. I don't want to sound dismissive of the points that Marika has raised, because I think they're valid ones. But I think that, you know, if we put policy ideas that are attempting to solve, I think, you know, pervasive problems, if we put them under a what-if compliance or implementation microscope, you know, at every step of the process, I'm concerned that what comes out the other side will either be non-existent or unenforceable, or you know, not solve the problem it was set out to do. So I think that they're valid points. I think, you know, let's encounter those problems before we attempt to solve them with additional language. Let's get the general principles down on paper and put them out there, and then let's see, you know, what transpires as a result of competing claims for emergency action channel or something like that. I would assume that one party in that scenario would have some documentation, that it would be up to ICANN or the registry to make a judgment that says that, you know, one side is telling the truth. But, you know, I really feel like, you know, there's so many rabbit holes that we can go down. I think we need to be cautious about going down them at this stage in the game when we're just trying to flesh out these ideas. Thanks.
Thanks, James. Okay. Other conversation about this paragraph, especially the switch to 4 hours. Oh, Marika, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Marika. If I can just, you know, respond, and I really appreciate the feedback that everyone has given. I think, you know, from my perspective, I'm trying to give as much feedback at this stage from, you know, ICANN's perspective, because, of course, when this moves into implementation, you know, staff will be tasked to write an implementation plan. So I think any clarity on certain issues we can get now will be really helpful, but at the same time, of course, when, you know, when the implementation plan is out, that will go out as well for public consultation. I'm really hoping as well that, of course, this group will still, you know, maybe remain in a dormant state, so at that stage it can comment as well, because, of course, there are other issues that will need to be dealt with in implementation, you know. For example, you know, how long are registrars given to provide the EAC data? What happens if they don't fill it in? You know, what kind of data would ICANN then put in there? So there are different steps that, you know, speaking to some of the people here in Marina del Rey that will be tasked with implementation, that, you know, go way beyond what, you know, this working group needs to do. But just want to make you aware that there are certain issues that might come up in implementation, but there are still, you know, plenty of opportunities at that stage to provide input and hopefully indeed make it as simple as possible.
This is Mikey again. Let me just respond to that. I think there are a couple of things. First, what we need to do is invent some scenarios to test this problem. If an elephant steps on the registrar's phone and they can't respond, or an earthquake, or the polar ice cap melts, et cetera, et cetera, I think we need to get a sense of some of the plausible scenarios that this could happen in. But the other point that I really want to amplify is that in Section 6 of this policy, it's the duty of the registry to do the transfer undo. There's no expectation, at least in my mind, that there's going to be a tremendous burden on anybody to do anything particularly different. Because documentation requirements are already contained in this policy, and the process of a transfer undo is already laid out. So I'm not expecting a tremendous change to ICANN process as a result of this. Michele, go ahead.
Right. Mikey, just coming back to this thing about the what-if type scenarios. Okay, the kind of the blunter, less tolerant version of me, it comes out, reaction would be expletive them, and you can choose whichever expletive you want to use, because I'm getting a little bit tired of being forced to pay for the screw-ups and the shortcomings and the general ineptitude of some people who operate in the internet industry in general, not just registrars. The more reasonable me would say, well, then maybe what we need to look at is some simple, not overly complicated, not overly burdensome reference to something along the lines of, I mean, basically what you're talking about is kind of, you know, natural disasters, acts of God, the kind of things that you might find as kind of boilerplate in a lot of contracts. You know, it's, I don't actually know, exigent circumstances is one possible term that somebody gave me. But, you know, the point being that we cannot possibly, we have to get the balance right. And look, what we're working on here, I think, and I'm feeling very optimistic, is that we can come up to something that is workable, that is, it's not going to make everybody happy. It's not going to fix all the evils in the world, but at least it means that we will have fixed this one part of the problem. And, you know, ultimately we cannot spend our entire life kind of worrying about the what ifs, you want to talk about the elephant. I mean, what if the elephant did this or the elephant did that or the cat ate my homework? We're not all 12-year-olds anymore. I haven't given the cat ate my homework excuse for a long time. My excuse these days is much blunter. It's more along the lines of, I was too tired, I didn't do it. You know, that's just me anyway, so I'll shut up now.
This is Mikey again. One idea that came to me during that was we could do something similar in this regard that we did in terms of the... further down in this document, you'll see that we refer to the RAA for the documentation requirements. It seems to me that this issue that's, you know, it's in the U.S. law, it's usually called force majeure. Surely there's force majeure kind of language already in the RAA, and maybe what we could do is refer to that.
I don't think there actually is, Mikey.
Well, if there isn't, then I think it would be a good question for the legal folks as to whether they want to only have a force majeure clause in one part of one policy. I think if there isn't such language in the RAA, then we're getting a little bit ahead of the curve on this. And that, you know, we should defer, I think, to the broader contract when it comes to issues that are really sort of outside the scope of this particular policy-making initiative. Bladel's saying no force majeure either. It seems to me that... go ahead, James.
Hi. Yeah, I was wondering if I could just kind of get us back, you know, onto the... out of the weeds and onto the high road a little bit, and just you know, continue to pull us back under the document. And just to say that, you know, there are going to be a lot of reasons why a small and or you know, more improvisational or ad hoc registrar is going to have problems meeting some of the deadlines or requirements or things like that. Those are the folks, they don't come to ICANN, they aren't on these calls, they don't participate in policy development, and they are the folks that a lot of the criticism in this industry is rightly directed towards. So, you know, I think, if nothing else, perhaps compliance with an EAC program would draw a bright line between those of us who do continue and, to participate and continue to drive this industry forward versus those who are continuously operating at the margins and causing us all problems and perception issues. Thanks.
Okay, so I'm going to do sort of a going once, going twice routine on the switching the 24 hours to 4. Is there anybody who disagrees with that idea that would like to voice their disagreement? I'm not seeing any, so I'm going to take that as a deal. You can have second thoughts till the end of the call, but to push us along, I agree. You know, we did get a little bit off on the weeds there. The next paragraph talks. I guess I just added this stuff. There wasn't any deleting going on, and. Basically, what we were doing was just tying it to the other section. here. Nothing particularly special. So I'm going to churn right ahead here. The next paragraph, both parties will retain written or electronic documentation. You can sort of see the dialogue there on the side. And then this is where we put the reference to the RAA in, just to bring it in line with that larger document. And then on the next page, the last page of this, we sort of backed off the language on ICANNs and left as much flexibility as we thought we could for ICANN to sort of figure out what they're going to do. So rather than insist on, in the first draft there was a schedule that said ICANN will conduct tests at least once a year and preferably once a quarter, a bunch of stuff like that. We took that out and essentially provided a little more wiggle room there. Marika, I saw your hand go up. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Marika. In relation to the written or electronic documentation, I received a comment of saying if it would make more sense to say something like correspondence may be retained in written or electronic form, because you're talking about written or electronic documentation. Well, I think you're trying to say that the correspondence may be kept either in paper format or in electronic format. It's just a minor point.
So, I mean, I was being a bad guy and reading the chat at the same time. So you're suggesting changing the language to, say, in written or electronic format?
Well, I would say correspondence will be retained in paper or electronic format.
Correspondence will be retained. Okay, I've got the MP3. I'm taking stupid notes. I think what I'd probably tend to do is look at the language in section 3.4 and mirror that. But let me take a crack at that after the call. It seems doable.
Okay.
And I'm kidding when I say it's the end of the call, people. Everybody sort of went crazy in the chat and said, Mikey, there are people that aren't on the call. You might want to give more time. That's fine. Then the only other, and this is new, is the last little paragraph inserts a clause into Section 6 that basically just refers back up to this and says that one of the now four reasons for a transfer undue by a registry is documentation provided by the registrar of record prior to transfer that the gaining registrar has not responded to a message via the EAC within the time frame specified. That's the thing that actually triggers the undue, and it ties those two pieces together. And that's part of the reason why I'm so comfortable with this change, is because we are really just adding one reason to an already existing process. And the reason is the EAC that we lay out in Section 4. James, go ahead.
Hi. So this is one area where maybe I'm going to contradict something I said a little bit earlier and would like to see a little bit more flexibility. And what I'm getting at here is that I want to make it clear, and maybe I'm not understanding, that a failure to respond to an EAC message can or may translate into a transfer undue, but it doesn't have to. And I'm thinking or envisioning of a scenario where I have a question about a transfer, or I feel that there's a transfer that's suspicious, but I don't necessarily want to undo it. I just need an emergency. And I guess I've answered my own question, and it's not an emergency, and I don't need to use the EAC. So
I was all ready to pull the trigger on that exact logic. So thank you for taking care of that for me. James and I, in full disclosure, James and I went back and forth a little bit on will versus may, and, we've landed on will for a whole bunch of reasons, which I'm happy to reiterate, but won't unless people want to hear them.
Mikey, this is Marika. On the reasons why you've changed it from, you know, may to will, I think it would be very helpful if you could write something up so we can actually include it in the report, not as maybe part of the policy proposal, but I think we need to explain a bit in the report, you know, why we've gone down certain roads and not others. So if you have any the arguments for that, it would be really helpful if you could, you know, maybe send that so I can include it in the notes of the report that will precede the actual recommendation.
I'm happy to do that. I think that there's really two things. One is that, and then the other is getting back to Simonetta's point, which is sort of laying out the other options for action by the registrant in all of this. So I think we've got some documentation that we need to generate to surround this. I think I'm done, unless folks have other comments. The chat's kind of going crazy, but McKaylee, I think I'll hand the microphone back
Rains.
To you and let you run it from here.
Can I call them Rains?
Rains. You're more than welcome to the Rains.
Yes, we're allowed to have horses here. We're not allowed to have guns, but we're allowed to have horses. Okay, thanks very much, Mikey, for all that. Okay, then. Does anybody have any issues, queries, or anything at the moment in relation to any of this document? Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. I'm just wondering whether some of you once, you know, I think for the next call we'll probably have the, you know, almost final draft of this that takes into account some, I think, of the minor points we discussed now. But I'm wondering as well if it makes sense then, once we have that draft, that some of you maybe go back to your respective stakeholder groups just to do a quick check. You know, as this proposal hasn't really gone out for, you know, we've outlined the broad concept but not the real details. So that we have a check with some of the different groups just to make sure that, you know, we did get it right, that there are no major issues that people have identified and that we're comfortable, you know, putting this in the final report and putting it forward to the council. I'm wondering if that is something people feel would be helpful or would make sense at this stage.
So who would be looking at this exactly, Marika?
I'm wondering, for example, as it mainly affects registrars, I'm wondering, for example, the registrar stakeholder group could just informally circulate it, basically saying, look, this is the, you know, basically almost final proposal that the working group wants to put into his report. You know, does any of you identify any major issues? Anything that we've overlooked or where you see, you know, real...
Okay, well, okay, if we can get a clean draft of that, I have no issue with circulating that with amongst the more active members of the stakeholder group.
McKaylee, this is Mikey. I'm going to jump in on this.
Yes,
I
go ahead.
I think that we need one other document before we do that, and that's
okay.
The... essentially, the surrounding rationale. I think if one thing we've learned from this before is that when we put the straight policy draft out there without any context, we get a heck of a lot of confusion. And rather than just sending this out without any surrounding context, I think we need to write something that introduces it. And maybe it's in the form of an FAQ, I'm not sure. But I think it would be a bad idea to send this document as it stands without some sort of support.
Okay. Rob?
It was only going back to the thing with the losing registrar reporting the failures. There's words like will and must. Obviously have legal connotations. It might be better if it was worded the losing registrar should report failures to respond to EAC, and failure to respond to an EAC request may result in a transfer under. It's simply otherwise you're saying it will always happen, and that may not necessarily be the right outcome.
But I think the entire point, Rob, was that this is what we're trying to do, is to make it to be the outcome.
Mikey,
go ahead, please.
This is essentially the conversation that James and I had, and my question to you, Rob, is can you come up with a scenario where the right outcome would not be a transfer undo? Because basically what we are trying very hard to do is avoid any policy that requires a dispute resolution as part of it. And, you know, that's why the scope of this is so limited. I am pretty emphatic about the logic of this, which is if this very narrow circumstance happens, then this other thing will happen as a result.
Aren't you still reliant on the registry doing the undo and whether or not they choose to do so? Not us actioning an undo. We're not sending a please undo the transfer command.
I think that's probably a question for a broader discussion of this policy. If this policy is optional for registries, then we've got a different problem to solve than the one you're describing. Because basically what this policy says now is if the following four circumstances occur, the registry will undo the transfer. That's Section 6.
Well, I think, Mikey, if there's an issue with how registries handle undos or don't handle them or whatever, then maybe that's something that the registry stakeholder group would be better positioned to address.
Essentially, if we're making transfer undos optional for registries, that's a whole different discussion than this one. Because there are three other reasons for transfer undos that are already in the policy. And so suddenly opening up this can of worms to say, transfer undos are optional.
Well, they shouldn't be optional because it kind of defeats the entire purpose of the exercise.
Right. That's the whole point.
I mean, unless, of course, I'm missing something blindingly obvious. Barbara, are you still with us?
I am still with you, and I agree that, you know, to the extent that, you know, registries receive a directive from the registrar in this type of situation where perhaps the other registrar is not cooperating, then I agree that it should not be an optional thing, that, you know, we should be able to rely upon the registrar who's submitting that to us to affect the undo.
Let me put another question to you. Based on your own experience and knowledge of your industry peers, do you think that there is even a remote possibility that any of your peers may have issues with this concept?
I don't think so. So long as you know, the circumstances are defined and there is, I guess, I don't know how to describe it, but basically there's, you know, in essence a release from liability. I mean, we have to be able to rely upon, you know, the directive that we're receiving from the registrar that, you know, they are acting in good faith and, you know, the other registrar has not been responsive, and so they're bringing it to us to be able to affect the undo.
Okay, we'll be working on the basis that in the context of this policy, what we're talking about, I mean, as I said already, is that, you know, all of the normal remedies that would be open and that we're making the normal assumptions that basically the registrar requesting it isn't a scumbag, is a registrar in good standing, isn't a criminal, etc., 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 etc. These are all just kind of safe assumptions that we're making without actually explicitly stating them.
Right.
So given all of the above, and based on the fact that we're dealing with it in this very, very narrow context, you wouldn't foresee any issues?
Correct.
Okay, thank you. Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. On the point, indeed, of you know, may, will, I still feel as well a bit uncomfortable on really making it so strict, because I'm wondering as well, you know, a situation where you could imagine, like, if a registrar indeed files an EAC, but in that, you know, four-hour window or whatever the window of response is going to be, he receives additional information which makes it no longer an emergency, but he did file that request. You know, he then has to report if there's no response. There's no option for him to say, okay, well, I did file a response, but in the meantime, I got new information, and, you know, it's fine.
But surely that constitutes as a response of sorts, Marika.
Well, but not
exactly.
If the information is not from the losing register, if it's some other information from, you know, whatever source. I'm just trying to see if, as well, I wish there would be as well a way of saying, like, in certain circumstances there might be a reason why there's no report or no reason to undo, even though there was no response and an EAC was filed.
Okay, Mikey has his hand up, so let's see if he's got some, and then Paul.
Second point to come back to, but then Mikey first responds.
Okay.
I think you almost said it perfectly, Michele. If the gaining registrar responds, the game is over. That's all that needs to happen. So if it turns out that a third party provides information that changes somebody's mind, that's great. The gaining registrar should still respond. What we're trying to do here is induce a conversation between the losing registrar and the gaining registrar. And if at the beginning of that conversation, the losing registrar says, oops, I'm sorry, I have gotten additional information since I filed my EAC with you and this issue is moot, that's fine. The gaining registrar will have responded. That immediately blows up the transfer undo, and the various people can go off and do whatever they do. So, again, the key here is to keep any hint of dispute resolution out of this process.
Paul, Rob, and we need to go back to Marika as well.
Okay, thanks, Michele. I think I agree with everything Mikey just said. He explained it. You know, in a scenario where circumstances change, if within the first 4 hours, gaining registrar has not yet responded, the losing registrar, upon further investigation, its own investigation, determines, whoops, there was something amiss, this wasn't in fact a hijacking, etc., there's not going to be anybody there to complain. So, I mean, I think in all the scenarios that we're describing, look, the whole point of EAC is to start a dialogue. And in circumstances where something has changed and somebody is, you know, the parties in question are communicating, if in fact there's no longer a problem, well, no problem is no problem. And like Mikey said, the original cause gets blown up, and we all go back to business as usual. The key here is to create a mechanism to facilitate communication. That's it. And then, you know, what gets done after that is between the parties to the situation. I think we are spending an inordinate amount of time what-if scenario mongering, and it's not really serving any useful purpose.
Okay, thank you, Paul. Rob, and then Mariko.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing with the idea. It's simply in terms of the structure of the wording. I'm not going to disagree at all with what Mike said, that if this should all blow up or go away, or the losing registrar suddenly gets, oh, actually they did send us that fax that said we should release it, in which case this all goes away. Its wording says that the failure to respond will be reported, and that in reporting it, it will undo the transfer. There's nothing in there that says, oh, the losing registrar can change their mind. And
okay, Rob, come on. Now, look, you provide hosting for companies of different shapes and sizes.
Yes.
Okay. Do you provide SLAs to your clients?
Depending on the service they've got, yes.
Okay. So working on the basis that you do provide SLAs to certain clients and that you understand the concept of an SLA, why would you not be willing to comply to an SLA from ICANN, which is basically what this is?
It's not a case of not wanting to comply with an SLA. It's a case of having to comply, even if the
But it's policy. I mean, if it becomes optional, then why would somebody actually do it? If it's optional.
Okay, I mean, like I say, it comes back to the legal use of things like will and must.
Yeah, but the point being, though, if we use something like should or could or anything like that, which leaves a narrow chance of of it not happening, then we might as well not actually have this, because from in my personal view, because it waters it down completely to render it useless.
Okay.
But that's, I mean, you know, you're entitled to your opinion. Marika and then Mikey.
Yeah, this is Marika. This relates back to an earlier comment from Mikey on writing the rationale. Just wanted to note as well, I think, you know, part of the rationale can already be found as well in the proposed final report, because I think we did outline there why we were, you know, moving towards the EAC. I think it probably just needs some, you know, further clarification in relation to the details that we've decided upon for the proposal, like, you know, the time frame, the will, may, all those issues. So I think we have a basis probably in the report already. We just need to beef it up a bit.
Okay, thank you. Mikey?
Oops, sorry, muted. I'm going to take one more run at Rob's comment, because I get what your concern is, Rob. But, again, the simple way to solve that problem is if the gaining registrar responds to the EAC. You know, let's say that the scenario you describe happens, and the losing registrar finds themselves in a circumstance where they don't want the transfer to happen because they've figured out that something else is going on, like Paul described. Two possibilities exist. One, and the most preferred possibility, is that the gaining registrar responded, and so as a result, it doesn't matter that the circumstances has changed, because the response is there, and that immediately voids the possibility of a transfer undue under this policy. The second, I suppose, informal option would be that the losing registrar, having found themselves in a circumstance where this isn't the appropriate thing to do, would either just cancel the emergency action request or send another one and say, never mind, and document it.
Yes.
You know, both of those, it seemed to me, are reasonable options in this circumstance. But the easiest way to solve this problem is just all registrars get in the habit of responding to emergency action requests, and all registrars and ICANN get in the habit of being very careful about when they issue these requests so that they don't abuse it.
Mikey, I don't know why I put myself in the queue, since I did take the reins back. Just one thing. I suppose in some ways I'll actually disagree with you to a certain point, because ultimately all we're talking about is getting a response from the gaining registrar.
Right.
And 4 hours is a very short window. So I'd work on the basis that, you know, you should just expect a response, even though the response might be Whiskey Tango Foxtrot.
Yeah, I think
you know,
right.
As in, that's a response. It may not be the response you're looking for, obviously, but it's a response.
Oh, no, I mean, in that circumstance, you know, where there's an actual disagreement between the two registrars, that's absolutely covered. The issue that Rob is describing is where the losing registrar realizes that they made a mistake, and this ticking time bomb of the automatic transfer undue is sitting there, even though the losing registrar doesn't want it to happen because they've figured out.
Yeah, but the counter argument I would have to that, though, is the fact that the gaining registrar is unable to answer within the 4-hour period would render them non-compliant.
Right, but let's say
which would identify an issue, a general issue with that registrar, as opposed to an issue with the specific transfer in question.
Right, but the transfer would be undone when, in fact, it should be.
Yeah, but this comes back to the root problem here. If the registrar is unable or unwilling to respond within the 4-hour window, regardless of the nature of the transfer in question, because remember, there's no arbitration here, then there is a systemic problem with the registrar in question.
Yes.
Rob?
So if I ring you up, Michele, and say, I've got a problem with this transfer, client says it shouldn't have gone, oh, no, sorry, I'm completely wrong, I've picked the wrong domain name.
Yeah, but you spoke, but I've replied to you already, Rob.
Right.
That's the entire point. Even if my reply to you is simply, I'm not sure what you're talking about, or whatever, I've replied to you.
Okay.
Right.
So somebody's going to have to verify that the other party isn't stopped.
Yeah, but this is the entire thing, as in, this comes back to the document. The entire concept here is, we're not making a judgment call, okay? We're not judging whether party A or party B is in the right or is in the wrong. We're not getting into an arbitration. It is not a policy dispute. It is none of those things. All of those policy dispute mechanisms, the WIPOs, the civil actions, all of that still remain open for use and abuse by anybody who wants to use them. Okay? What we're looking at here is a very, very simple thing, which is why I keep referring to the SLA concept, because it kind of works for me. In an SLA, you're not going to guarantee to your client, no matter how much they're paying you, that 100% of the time you are going to be able to solve the problem within a fixed period of time.
That's the SLA say that we expect to be able to do X, and if we don't meet X, this is what you get back in.
Oh, yeah. There's all that stuff. But the point I'm getting at, though, the key thing is that the SLA is that you will respond within a period, generally speaking. There's something about response times in there usually. And, you know, as long as you, depending on the SLA that you have, you know, but basically, it's like, you know, the point of the matter is, if, for example, you contact GoDaddy's emergency contact line, GoDaddy will answer their contact line. Even if you afterwards discover that you didn't really have a proper reason to contact GoDaddy's emergency line, for whatever reason, the point being, though, that GoDaddy will be compliant because they answered the phone, or they answered the email, or they sent you back a fax. Does that kind of make sense to you?
It does. I mean, it's purely the bit about it's reported by the losing registrar, and then it automatically goes through. I just stuck on the chat. I mean,
okay, I'll put you through this way, right? If you have a look at historically what happened with regard to certain registrars over the last 2 or 3 years, Rob, are you up to date with all your ICANN fees? Is ICANN compliance hounding you over anything at present?
Only over one.
Okay, but just generally speaking, the answer is kind of pretty much no, because you're probably talking about you've got to resolve it. At least I hope you are.
Yeah, we had an issue with one of the Iron Mountain deposits, the wrong thing.
Yeah, okay, but look, that's fine. Everybody has that problem at least once. But what I'm trying to say to you is that in general terms, you are currently compliant.
Yes.
You would not be considered to be a zombie registrar, an uncontactable registrar, a registrar who does not respond, or any of those kind of things. Mm-hmm. Okay? So what are you worried about? Why are you worrying or concerning yourself about somebody who is not going to respond? Why would you be financing their business?
I certainly shouldn't be, and I'm sure
but that's the entire point. That is the entire point. If you are paying your fees, and I'm paying my fees, and Network Solutions are paying their fees, and GoDaddy are paying their fees, why would we be financing and propping up other business models where they're not actually doing what they're meant to do? Thank you. I rest my case. Next. Any other queries or questions on this? Okay, then. We'll have a clean copy of this document, and then we will be able to use some of the background material that is in the actual report to act as an introduction, and then it's suggested that we possibly circulate this to our own stakeholder groups informally to get some kind of feedback. Is everybody agreed on that as a course of action? Does anybody have any comments or any issues with that? Bob? Any issues?
That's good.
Okay. And I've always liked Perry Mason. Any other issues, any comments on that? No? Okay, then. Could we have the public comments back up on screen, please? And bearing in mind we're into the last 30 minutes. Which James is calling the bonus round. I like that, actually. Bonus round. Okay, so, Rob, go ahead.
Oh, sorry, I think I left there from earlier.
Okay, that's okay. All right, now, Rika's telling me that we are on page 4. This thing not working for me, sorry. It works and then it just stops working. Page 4, number 15. Okay, just bear me 1 second. Right. Okay. Page 1 from 15. What qualifies a response? Most members of the registry stakeholder group feel that as a minimum, a positive confirmation of receipt and initial human contact is appropriate. I think we've answered that in detail already. Does anybody have any other comments on this? No? Moving on? Fine. From the business constituency, a non-automated response would be preferable, but BC would defer to registrars and registries in determining what qualifies as a response, be that email, phone call, fax, etc. So I would say thanks to the BC, and I think we've covered that in detail. From the ICA, the different responses must be clearly delineated and mechanisms must be set in place to prevent abuse of the EAC in non-emergency situations. Mikey?
I just wanted to chime in on this one. I think we've handled that in the policy, but I think that this is one of those things that we want to put in our FAQ or surrounding documents that says this is only for emergencies. Start using it for non-emergencies and you get whacked. And I'm wondering whether we need to say that in the policy or not. I'd be inclined not to, but I leave that to others who live in this world more than me.
Mikey, you suggested that whacking people, which I presume was a kind of a colorful way of referring to compliance will make their lives miserable. Is that what you were referring to?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, this in a way is another one of those rabbit holes that we could go down, because then we have to define what is an emergency, and I would prefer not to do that. But I think that's the way that this is addressed.
Okay. Well, I mean, personally, and this is just my own view, I would not want us to go down too many rabbit holes because, well, you know, rabbits live down those holes and I wouldn't want to upset them. Marika, you have a hand.
Yeah, this is Marika. I agree that it's a rabbit hole, but at the same time, you might put compliance in a situation where they then would need to judge what consists of an emergency or not. Because if you, for example, imagine that indeed a registrar starts complaining, saying, well, you know, this registrar constantly keeps on contacting me using the EAC, but I don't think it, you know, relates to an emergency. While the registrar that is using the EAC might say, well, we think it is an emergency. So I don't know if there are any kind of, you know, if there's something we can put in there, you know, I mean, I think we're mainly talking here about hijacking, but some kind of description, because otherwise we might put compliance into a position where they need to judge without any kind of guidance on what this working group intended to be an emergency.
Okay. Mikey, is that an old hand, a new hand, fresh hand?
Sorry, old hand. Taking it down.
Okay, that's fine. So it's kind of crusty. Is an auto-response sufficient? An auto-response is not sufficient. ALAC can registry stakeholder group. And we agree with that, I think. Okay, I'm going to run through these really, really quickly. If people don't interrupt me, I will just keep going, just so you're aware. Okay, the goal of the EAC should be to resolve the issue, not to merely advise the receiving registrar that an issue exists. That's in the registry stakeholder group, and we would politely disagree. We're talking about the using the EAC to start the dialogue. Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, Michele, I agree with you. We can disagree, but I believe that, remember the time frame in which these comments were posted, our concept was kind of poorly defined back then. We've come a long ways now, and I think it'll be very clear to everybody that it's a communication channel, so it's good to move on.
Okay. I'm just trying to go through the comments that we have, so that's fine. What the hell is GD? Is GD GoDaddy or GD is GD something else?
Yes, GD is GoDaddy.
Oh, they get their own special acronym. Okay. Right, an auto-response is not sufficient, but auto-responses may be used during the process to keep parties informed of the INTA, so that's fine. ICANN compliance should test this channel periodically to ensure a non-automated response, and we have that covered. Now, should there be any consequences when a response is not received within the required time frame, and both ALAC, INTA, and the registry stakeholder group all agree that there should be consequences. The registry stakeholder group also go into further detail on what those consequences could be. I think we do cover that in our document.
This is Mikey. Let me jump in here. We are pretty open-ended on those consequences. The registries are requesting something that's a little bit more structured than what's in the current draft.
Now, is that a good thing or a bad thing, Mikey?
Well, I'm putting it out there as an I don't know. And, you know, Barbara, if you wanted to chime in, I could go either way.
Let's go with something very simple. Is there anybody who is against the idea of us stating in simple terms something along those lines? Basically what their comment summarizes. Does anybody have any feelings about this at all? Okay, personally, I think we should kind of fill the void a little bit, because otherwise we're going to have problems with council who are going to ask, you know, what exactly, where's this, you know, they're going to ask for an explanation as to the gap. So maybe, Mikey, you could add something in.
I'd be happy to. I'll drag you back to the draft. The sentence that we have in the draft right now says, failure to respond to an EAC will result in a transfer undo in accordance with Section 6. That's the non-controversial part. The part that we would be revising is the part that says, and may also result in further action by ICANN up to and including non-renewal or termination of accreditation, but we don't specify any rules around that. And what I'm hearing is the possibility of writing some, you know, putting some numbers in there and some time frames, so on and so forth. So that's the, I don't want to just write that on my own. Again, I was the one that wrote the BC position that said that we defer to the registries and registrars on issues like this, and so I'd like some instruction before I write stuff.
Okay. So
now, is there a, this is Mikey again, is there a comparable escalation in some other policy that we could mimic or refer to or mirror?
I'd ask Paul Diaz or James if they could answer that. Guys?
Yeah, it's Paul McKaylee. I can't think of one, and I was going along that line. I hate to punt this, but I honestly need more time to think it through and would ask that we continue this particular conversation on the list.
Okay, that's fine by me.
Because I was just going to say, McKaylee, I agree with you. I think it's a good idea to have some filling of the void without going so far to be hyper-prescriptive, and then that creates a, you know, additional unintended thing.
No, totally. No, I mean, the big fear I have, and this is just my own personal kind of interpretation slash gut feeling, call it what you will, is that the GNSO is much happier when working groups send them things that can be kind of signed off on simply without leading to extra working groups or implementation groups or whatever the hell they're calling them this week. So the more precise, the more direction we can give, the better. Okay, so look, if we can come back to that one in the interim. Mikey, go ahead.
Just one more thing to throw into the sort of intellectual pot, and that is when we're finishing this conversation off on the list, we'll also want to think about the scope of this escalation. I mean, you know, right now we're down in a subsection of the whole IRTP, and the question really is, what happens when there are violations of the IRTP policy? And we may want to write that escalating sequence of events to refer to the whole policy rather than just this little subsection. I don't know the answer to that either. I mean, it's, again, one to defer to you guys who are smarter about this than me. But I think one of the things we don't want to do is have one part of this policy very prescriptive and the rest of the policy not prescriptive. That'll confuse people no end.
Thanks, Mikey. I'm now confused, but that's okay. Right then, 24 is... 24 is to do with the remedial actions against the registrar again, so I think we'll discuss that next week. 25... part of that we've covered in the EAC. The other part is going to be the same thing as we're going to discuss next week. Right, hold on a second. 27. This is slightly different. This is not to do with the registrars or the registries. This comment refers directly to the registrant, or a registrant, more to the point. How would we like to handle this one? And the comment is, effective sanctions must be established against a domain seller who initiates an illicit reversal action. Paul Diaz?
Yeah, thanks, Michaela. I don't think that this one applies because, again, now that we've further defined EAC and made it clear that it's only for registrars, with the involvement of registries, this whole process, we don't have a situation like 27, where the end user can initiate the clawback. I think this is a clawback scenario that they're worried about.
Okay, so how would we, what would we say then in simple terms? That because as we have narrowed this down, we don't feel that this is an issue, or
this is Mikey, you could say something like, domain sellers do not have access to the EAC channel, and thus this is moot.
Well, that's nice. I like that. I like that. Excellent. Thank you. Okay, then. 28. Consider modifying the IRTP to mandate a transfer undo in cases where the gaining registrar does not respond in a timely way to an emergency action request regarding a suspected domain name hijacking. And I think that is effectively being incorporated into the document that we're currently working on. So I presume that was Mikey's wording, which is why it looks terribly familiar. Any other comments on that, on those? I think what we will do is, okay, we'll just do the next couple of ones and then we will call it a day. Is there a limited time following a transfer during which the emergency action channel can be used? From the registries, recommend this channel must be invoked within 7 days of the alleged incident. After this period and for other non-urgent and non-emergency situations, the existing communication channels and transfer dispute resolution policy process should be used. Mikey?
This is Mikey again. James and I were very careful not to put a time frame in this policy because what we did not want to do is provide a roadmap for abusers to time their actions. And so by consciously dodging the time frame issue, what we're really striving to do is prevent an opportunity for a hijacker to wait one day past some deadline before they make their move. So I would lobby that we have addressed it in the current policy by not specifying a time frame.
Okay. Okay, but how does one address then such queries as the next one, like the ICA comment? The time period in which a domain transfer reversal can be sought must be far shorter than 6 months post-transfer.
This is Mikey again. I think part of it is addressed by the narrowness of the revised policy. What the ICA is concerned about is the clawback scenario.
Yep.
And that's mitigated in a couple of ways. It's mitigated because the registrant no longer has access to this process. It's also mitigated by the ease with which the gaining registrar can immunize themselves. All they have to do is respond. It's that whole conversation we had about 10 or 15 minutes ago where if a clawback attempt, and again, this is purely the clawback scenario that the ICA is worried about. If somebody's trying to claw back a domain, all the gaining registrar has to do is call back, and that immediately removes the threat of the transfer undo. And
okay,
that's part of the reason why I think we need some sort of an FAQ, because this comment is really aimed at the last iteration of the policy, and I don't think it's a concern in this one.
Okay. No, that's fine. I think that answers it. So basically, to kind of rephrase you slightly, the ICA and other entities are concerned about about clawbacks and other abuse, and other possible abuse. Working on the basis that the registrars involved in aftermarket activities are acting in good faith, this should not be an issue because as long as they reply, there is no risk of a unilateral transfer, or words to that effect. Mikey, is that okay?
Oh yeah, that's fine. Sorry.
Okay. Support for a reasonably long time. Oh God, sorry, I'm really not able to manage coherent sentences. Support for. Support for a reasonably long window, with the BC suggesting a range of 60 to 180 days. Mikey, is that you again?
Yeah, that's me. And again, this is addressed in the existing draft by the fact that we simply do not specify a time window at all. And I think the PC is fine with that. The real criterion for this is an emergency. And when there's an emergency, that's when this gets invoked. And that emergency can happen in 10 minutes or 3 weeks or 5 months. But that's where I think we do need to clarify the emergency stuff just a little bit. But in terms of this one, I'll take a flyer and speak for the PC. I think we're fine with the current draft.
Okay, thank you. It's practically the end of the 90 minutes, so I'm going to give you all back about 3 minutes, which is very generous of me. So I'll speak to you all next week. Marika, I believe you are not joining us next week because you're off gallivanting.
Yes, that's correct. I'm on vacation next week, so would you like me to get someone else from policy staff to support the call, or you'll manage by yourselves for 1 week?
Can't we annoy Christina?
Yes, but Christina manages the call. I don't know if she necessarily will want to update documents and take notes.
Oh, okay.
I can ask Margie otherwise to cover.
Well, that's the middle of the month. That's kind of, is that which time zone is she in?
It will be very early for her.
Yeah, I'm just always very conscious of dragging people very early out of their beds. So I don't think it's very, if I can avoid doing it. Are any of the Europeans around?
If one of you, because I think the main thing that might be there for me is to update the common review tool. So if one member of the working group would just like to keep track on what I should put in the common review tool, I think that that's all basically.
No, I mean, we're reasonably well behaved. We haven't squabbled that much most of the time. So enjoy your week off. Are there any other issues for anybody? No? Okay, then. Speak to you all next week, then. Bye-bye.
Bye, McKaylee.
Bye.
Thanks, McKaylee.
Bye, McKaylee. Thanks.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye.